3348 is the Marine Spill Response Corporation. We had a fair amount of discussion with their incurring of liability in the process of cleaning up and not taking anything away from the original person who spilled, nor anything beyond, what's the standard we have here?
Grossly negligent.
They still have to be responsible if they were grossly negligent.
That's amendments to Ag.
Madam Chair, there are no amendments to the bill.
No amendments to the bill.
Madam Chair, I'd move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. are the sponsors here? We probably ought to get their word in blood that we're not going to have any other floating issues attached to this bill when it gets to the House.
Well,
oh, when it gets to the, well, it won't. That's what
we're not
saying.
The House is it. This thing going.
There are no amendments. Okay, so it's up to us to decide whether we want to amend this bill with all those bad things.
Good bill.
Okay, Senator Shoemaker has moved House Bill 3348 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please. Senator Springer?
Madam Chair, I'm going to resist the temptation to ask that this go to Ag and Natural Resources Committee, although that's where the major oil spill legislation has originated, and this, to me, is properly ought to be part of that discussion. I've had a chance to talk with the sponsors at length, and they make a good case, but I kind of have this old-fashioned sense that if you're negligent, you ought to be responsible. So I can't support this bill.
Okay. Anyone else? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Ben.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
No.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Okay. 2374.
Madam Chair, there's a proposed amendment to this bill.
Okay.
In keeping with our hearing.
Bill has amendments. He will explain in keeping with our hearing. 2374. This is a court administrator bill. It has to do with requesting financial information from banks and other financial institutions to verify indigency or not. Bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill was last before us on May 29th. At that time, we had some testimony concerning the discovery or the request of information from state agencies and how that may be contrary to federal law. And before you have an amendment, not in LC form, but it will be in LC form before it goes to the floor, obviously, dated June 3rd, 1991, and this makes it clear that an administrator shall forward to the state agency a certification signed by the person about whom the requested information is sought. And then removal of a comma there, the comma should not be there, that authorizes a release of information. And this information relates to indigent defense and the person being indigent and requesting counsel from the court. And it amends on page 2, line 10 of the bill.
Okay, other discussions?
I'll move the amendment.
Okay, Senator Hamby moves the amendment dated June 3rd, offered by the Oregon Judicial Department. Are there objections to the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Okay. How are we on this
bill?
Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2374 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye.
Motion carried, thank you. House Bill 2266.
Madam Chair, this bill was last before the committee also May 29th, and I have a set of amendments which takes out on page 2, lines 40 and 41 and 42 that were left in there inadvertently.
2266.
In my recollection, that this bill deals with the notification under the Tulsa case, is that right?
Yes, Madam Chair, as it relates to people who have an interest in will,
right.
As opposed to creditors, which is quite similar to the Tulsa case.
Mr. Shoemaker needs it. We need to give him. And we have amendments. Sort of remain, those just clean up amendments.
That's three amendments, Madam Chair. Yes, they remove language that was inadvertently left in the bill after right. Amendments made in the House.
I'll move the A3 amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Hanby has moved the dash A3 amendments. Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Senator Shoemaker, I think this is one of the bills that you missed the other night. And I don't know if you had a chance to just scan it. It seems to be fine.
I'll go with it.
Okay, Senator Shoemaker moves House Bill 2266 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm not sure I'd be the movers.
Okay, well, that's okay. We'll go. Let's. That doesn't mean you necessarily have to carry.
All right, okay.
Discussion, folks? Thank you. Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye.
Motion carried. House Bill 2382.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was last before us on May 10th and is brought to us from the International Law Section of the Oregon State Bar. And I believe Mr. Bruce Anderson is here if we have any detailed questions. But there are no amendments to the bill, and what it does is, under certain arrangements, allows for causes of action to be brought to arising from pollution beyond the boundaries of the United States if there's a comparable agreement between, for example, the province of Canada and the state of Oregon. At the last meeting, we had some objection expressed to this bill from the Associated Oregon Industries, but I got a letter today dated May 31 from Mr. Witte, James Witte, who testified here the last time. Said, as promised, we have researched House Bill 2382 and find no problems and therefore have no objections, period.
Okay. Pleasure of the committee on this bill. I guess it allows us to sue or be countersued by Canadians if they have a reciprocal agreement.
I'll move the bill.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker moves.
To the floor with the due pass.
Senator Shoemaker moves House Bill 2382 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. We have no amendments, right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Discussion. Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye.
Motion carried. Thank you. House Bill 2668.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill was last before the committee on May 13th, and it relates to extending the statute of limitations for child abuse from the current 5 years after attaining the age of 18 to 6 years. From attaining the age of 18, or if the injured person has not discovered the injury or the causal connection between the injury and the child abuse, then 3 years from the date of discovery or when discovery should have taken place. I have a set of amendments, Madam Chair, for the committee to consider.
Yeah, I just, through some discussions about putting some ending time on this as to leave it open, we have an amendment which the committee might choose to consider, which talks about a limitation of 40 years of age.
Right, Madam Chair. This would be an ultimate statute of repose, meaning that when the person, the victim, has become 40, then regardless of the date of discovery, the action would could not be brought forward.
So other than that, the bill is in basically just sort of putting some far end tag on it. So we need to have some discussion to see to understand what it is. Questions? We had a fair lot of.
It's reasonable.
Yeah, amendment. I think it is.
I'll move A-3.
Okay, Senator Hamby moves the A-3 amendments. And we've had a lot of communications in support of this bill, and I think that it is, well, it does stretch to a large degree what kind of evidence you're going to end up with at that level. I do think it's, I'm certainly willing to support the efforts to be made for people to, when they discover it or when they know that this is, comes to their attention or they're out of the, sort of their, should I say, sphere of understanding that, that we ought to try to make some modifications. Are there objections to the A3 amendments? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you. Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2668 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, Senator Brockman.
Madam Chair, didn't we have a bill in here or someplace that, that changed the definition of sexual penetration with a foreign object as male?
Yes, we did pass. We have it. Yes, we have.
I don't remember.
We had a hearing on it. I'm not sure we've actually passed it out yet, but when we do...
Because that is stated in this
right. When
this
we
bill.
Do, there will be a conflict amendment which will bring through and re
just checking.
Re-amend this bill. It's,
okay.
Okay. Call the roll, please. Hey.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Let's move to House Bill 2375. If you're ready on the professional corporation piece, Senator Shoemaker, or if you want to go ahead and take up the House Bill 2594 first.
Well, I think we're
okay. House Bill 2375.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill relates to the professional corporations, and the key issue in this bill, the one with the most controversy, is that of vicarious liability of between professional shareholders of the bill. I have two sets of amendments before me. One is the -4, which is a technical amendment that would clarify that it applies to shareholders of a professional corporation within Oregon. That was submitted to us by the Stoll Reeves Law Firm, and I have a rough -8 amendment, which relates to a cap on joint and several liability.
Great. Okay, we need to then figure out where, who's here, and how these amendments came from.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
That all bit,
please. Madam Chair, the -4 amendments to the engrossed version, as I said earlier, came from come from a law firm, Stoll Reeves, and they're concerned is that if their amendment is not passed in, it could be read as requiring that a foreign professional corporation rendering professional services have a majority of its shares held by persons licensed in Oregon, even only one or two shareholders or employees of the corporation actually renders professional services in Oregon.
So this was testified to at the work at the hearing.
Last hearing.
And this is the follow-up on that, just closes the...
That's correct, Madam Chair. The Dash 8 amendments are...
Okay, let's talk about the A4s first.
Okay.
Anyone have any objections to the A4 amendments? Get those incorporated. Okay, the Chair would move the A4 amendments. Hearing no objections, that's taken care of. Okay, now we get to the nut of the bill and see whether we're going to end up with a bill or not.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, if I could just run there are some other additional parts to it. And on line 1 of page 1 of the Dash 8, it says, delete permitted them and inserted expressly authorized. What that is intended to do under current professional corporation law, you are permitted to operate in any other business form permitted by law, regulation, or standard of conduct of the profession. Permitted has been interpreted to mean unless the regulating body or the statute says you can't do it, you can do it. It's more acquiesce. This would change it to expressly authorized because the issue is out there of professionals incorporating under the Business Corporate Act. So what this would do is that, for example, a lawyer who's incorporated under the Business Act could not do so unless the Oregon State Bar expressly said you can incorporate under the Business Act. The rest of the going on to the page 2 is some language that I've been working with in Senator Shoemaker on professional corporations in the law of Oregon right now. A shareholder in a corporation, a professional corporation, is vicariously liable for the actions of other shareholders in the corporation. The bill as currently drafted would eliminate that vicarious liability so that if one shareholder were liable and his assets were not sufficient to cover the liability, the other shareholder would not be liable for his actions. It would be treating shareholders in a professional corporation similarly to shareholders in a business corporation. This bill, what this does is it sets forth vicarious liability not exceeding $500,000 for each shareholder licensed as a physician by the Board of Medical Examiners, and I'm reading from lines 3, I, J, and K. However, vicarious liability shall not be imposed to the extent there are assets, including insurance, available to satisfy the claim in the amount of $500,000 times the number of shareholders licensed within the state to render the same professional services. Then it would set a different cap, vicarious liability, for all the professions holding licenses to render professional services in the state, not to exceed $300,000 for each shareholder who hold a license to render professional services within the state. However, here, vicarious liability should not be imposed to the extent there are assets, including insurance, available to satisfy the claim in the amount of $300,000 times the number of shareholders licensed within the state.
Okay. Senator Shoemaker, you want to speak to this,
sure.
Invite people up to...
Yeah, this is the bill that I've been thinking a lot about since I became aware of it a couple of months ago. And I guess I'm not comfortable with totally releasing professional people from vicarious liability. I think that's part of your responsibility as a professional to take responsibility for the people that you associate with. And if there's a financial responsibility, that sort of is, that's what says it. That's what makes it so. On the other hand, I think not have a limit on that is not fair. I think it should be a sufficient amount so that it's a significant liability, enough so that you take it really seriously, but not so much that it would ruin you. And of course, I'm very aware of the Labenthal and Horwath situation in which fellow shareholders in distant states acted quite unethically and illegally and their liability was visited on domestic shareholders in amounts which will ruin them if the way out of that is not found. Striking the balance is the tough part. So what I'm suggesting here is what I think is a balance, and that is that there be a limitation of vicarious liability of $300,000 for most professionals, $500,000 for physicians, recognizing that medical malpractice is probably the most sensitive of the malpractice situations where you have personal, you know, damage to people's health, and does result in the greatest amount of damage and the most frequent litigation. So I'm suggesting a $300,000 vicarious liability cap for most and a $500,000 liability cap for doctors, and also suggesting that if the professional corporation carries insurance and has other assets available to respond to the claim equal to the total of the vicarious liability cap times the number of shareholders, Oregon shareholders, that would either eliminate or, to the extent of those assets, reduce that vicarious liability. In other words, the professional corporation can insure against that vicarious liability, and the limits of that insurance would be reasonable. I know there's a problem about stacking and all those other things. I think those things can be worked out. The other change that you'll find in this proposed amendment is that even for interstate corporations, that the vicarious liability be contained among those who are practicing within this state. That the total cap relate to the number of shareholders. Each shareholder within this state would have that cap, and the insurance that the corporation would have to have to avoid that potential personal vicarious liability would relate to the number of shareholders practicing within this state. So it's a proposal. I think it's reasonable. I don't know that there's a perfect answer here, but I'm suggesting this. At least it's something we can focus on.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I don't know if Senator Shoemaker mentioned it, but on the page 3, you'll see starting at line 16, a foreign professional corporation who practices in the state. One problem you have right now, one potential problem, is the fact that you have foreign professional corporations practicing in the state, and there's some question out there as to how they would be treated. This is intended to make sure that a shareholder of a foreign professional corporation who practices in this state shall be treated the same as a domestic professional corporation shareholder. Mm-hmm. Because there's a potential loophole right now. There are law firms in Portland whose main office is in Seattle who are professional corporations out of the state of Washington where there is no vicarious liability on shareholders.
Okay. Further comments? Senator Springer.
I'm trying to sort through this amendment that Senator Shoemaker shared with us, and I don't know if there are any kind of equal protection arguments that would apply, or if we're able to sort of draw some kind of rational basis for the distinctions we've made in terms of what recovery is going to be available between, I guess, different classes of people who may be asserting liability and seeking recovery.
I acknowledge that there could be an equal protections problem, and I think it would be appropriate to have legislative counsel take a look at that.
I guess in that light, you interested in him, Mr. Can you come up? He's waiting patiently.
If Tom can help me out, I would welcome the assistance.
Okay, Mr. Cooney.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Bunn.
We might first do a straw poll and see if there's enough interest in the amendments to spend a lot of time on them.
Yeah, well, I think we just need to, let's answer this one question first.
I shared Senator Springer's concerns. I particularly
have concern about health care providers' limitation at 500 and others at 300. Now, the health care provider that we refer to is the DO, the MD, and the podiatrist. But you also have nurse practitioners, psychologists, and other health care providers who are doing closely enough of the very same thing that I am concerned that you could run into an equal protection. Why are they being distinguished against versus the others? And so I think there is a risk that if you do pass this, that you'll have a challenge on that basis. The other problem that I see is I don't know that you're really accomplishing anything because, you know, 500,000 times the number of shareholders can get to be a huge number, and not every malpractice policy for physicians stacks, so that you may only have one limit applicable, and so you're not really giving any relief to the other shareholders. Some of the policies do, some don't, and we know the lawyers doesn't. So I think you're creating a real problem when you get into that area. But my big concern is if you're going to go to this, some type of a numbered cap, that it be uniform so we don't encounter that type of a challenge in the courts.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the distinction that I think exists is that the extensive liabilities of the health care providers are not found among chiropractors and podiatrists and nurse practitioners, but are found probably among surgeons, neurologists, and others who are performing very intricate procedures, which are reserved, and properly so, for physicians. And I mean, they're the guys who really do things which can cause extreme damage, and they're the ones who are compensated.
Well, there's a yes and no to that. I mean, yes, there is a part of that that I think is in reality, but there's another part. The failure to diagnose breast cancer isn't limited to MDs. I mean, that's nurse practitioners, chiropractors, physicians assistants, things of that sort. Lawyers, when you're handling these savings and loan cases, are talking big numbers. And so if we're going to give some relief to the professional, let's give it either totally or let's give it uniformly, and that's what I propose.
Okay. Senator Hill?
Madam Chair, I guess that, especially in light of those comments, I've tried to think a lot about this situation, too, and I guess, oddly enough, for the medical profession, my perception is that people tend to rely on an individual doctor in their situations, and I don't know how much you would hold other physicians who happen to be working in the same clinic or whatever, but when it comes to other professional corporations, when it comes to law firms, accounting firms, and those type of situations, you really are relying on the reputation of that firm. You go there with the idea you're not maybe even looking for a specific doctor. You're looking for this law firm, this accounting firm has this reputation. And if I go there, I may not know anything about the individual that I end up having to work with. But I feel that whole firm, that accounting firm, this brokerage firm, or whatever, that whole entity is behind me. And that's the way that I look at it. So I have just come to the conclusion that the amendments I have to, I think that this is quite an attempt to find that balance. But I think that there are advantages to bigness. The larger firms, the various types, make a lot of money, and that, to some degree, has a lot to do with their reputation. So I just think, frankly, that this is really a bad policy, and I have to say that one of the most difficult things that all of us have in terms of professionals, is policing ourselves as professions. And I think that when you have the hammer hanging over you, that my colleague can drag us down, I think that's a real good incentive to make sure that everybody toes the line and do as they should do. Because a lot of these situations get very difficult, and self-policing of professions is something that I'm not sure that there have been many professions, if any professions, who've been able to achieve it. And I think we should have as much pressure on to do that as possible. So I'm not going to be supporting the bill.
Okay. The bill as it stands, or the amendments?
Or the amendments, Madam Chair.
Okay. Anybody else? Senator Bunn?
I think the amendments simply make it a little more confusing and complicated. I think the bill itself is workable.
So we got one for the bill, one against the bill, one for amendments. Okay?
Well, Madam Chair, let's put it to the test. I'll move the amendments. Although...
The civil compromise agreement, which is the third page there, when you read through it, you'll see it doesn't obligate the defendant to do anything. All it says is that the victim acknowledges satisfaction and agrees to drop the case. And that's, in effect, indeed, what happens in practice in all these cases, or most of them, at least. The defendant, in fact, just convinces the victim to go ahead and drop it. It's important to remember that this is not a level playing field. And these victims are, as I said, they're very vulnerable people. Intimidation and control are the whole essence of domestic violence in the first place, and these people sometimes have been regularly intimidated and victimized over years. The purpose of civil compromise is to resolve wrongful conduct outside the criminal justice system, and instead of punitive sanctions, to provide for restitution for an injury that's done. And I think the statute, the civil compromise statute, is basically designed for property crimes, and that's how it's best used. But where no restitution to the victim is ever paid or ever intended, and it's nothing but an agreement to drop the case, then the whole purpose of civil compromise is not being served. Even if the victim does agree, or if the court makes him agree, to get some sort of counseling, which is seldom done, those agreements are unenforceable, of course, because what's happened is that the case is dismissed. It isn't like a civil compromise in a property crime where there's a promissory note or cash payment or something like that. It's just a hollow promise. So the thing is basically a I'm trying to think of the word from law school. It's not coming down. I think it's nugatory, isn't that it? Agreement. The National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and it's in this, as I say, a little pamphlet that was handed out to you, recommends against civil compromise in these cases. It's been a problem in a number of states. Several states have done and are doing what House Bill 3051 would do, which is to abolish it in domestic violence cases. And let me just end by saying, as bad as the criminal justice system sometimes is, and I'm as aware as anyone of how that is, where these dismissals of phony compromises are done really sends a message that domestic violence in the state is okay, and that is the message that's out there, I regret to say. So I urge that you do pass House Bill 3051 out with a do pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
Steve, what would happen or what should happen if before the dismissal of the criminal charge, the victim and the accused enter into an agreement enforceable agreement that amounts to a completed civil compromise in which the defendant agrees to make things right or to pay money or do whatever. What ought happen in that case, and what would happen in that case?
It's perfectly possible, of course, in that rare case, to order restitution as part of a probationary sentence if the defendant were to plead to the charge or be convicted of the charge. So it's certainly possible to have reparations made. What happens in these cases really is that he may send her to the hospital, but it's his wife, so the money's coming out of one pot or one insurance carrier or something like that. We're really not talking about the kind of restitution that one stranger may make to another. Give you an example. If this bill were to pass in this form, and a stranger-to-stranger assault, let's say a guy hits another guy in a bar and causes him some medical costs or something, it might be appropriate in a case like that. But you're talking about different kinds of players. You're not talking about a situation where these people are one domestic unit, which is usually the case, or a case where one party has regularly intimidated and coerced and injured the other over a period of years. You're talking about a place where you could argue at least civil compromise might be appropriate. And if 3051 were to pass, that would still be true. So it limits it to the area of domestic violence. But going on here. Does that answer your question?
Well, if the two parties are most involved were to agree to something that was appropriate or seemed appropriate between them, is there a way to use that to influence or to bring about a consistent criminal decision? And can you tie it all in together within the context of the criminal case that's ongoing?
Well, I think you could.
Does that happen now?
It doesn't now, because if there's a civil compromise, well, let me just put this way. I've never seen one that was really an honest civil compromise. Okay. I've yet to see one.
It just doesn't happen.
I've ordered.
You take these cases to the courts. What do you have when you're done with all of that?
You mean once they've been convicted?
Yeah, once you have a misdemeanor, we've gone through and you have a misdemeanor. Then what happens?
Okay.
Are they back together? Or are they out? They're still living.
Sometimes.
What's the material effect of this?
The defendant. You're talking about in terms of the marital relationship.
No, I just mean what's the outcome? Outcome.
Probationary sentence where there's some supervision. I think this is really the key. There's some supervision over the defendant who, if he needs alcohol treatment, somebody's going to see that he goes, or has his probation revoked.
Into a position where we're not having it. Well, maybe if in fact we're going to limit probation supervision to personal offenses, I guess that would basically we're now after this budgetary session saying anybody who's convicted of misdemeanor is not going to have probation supervision based on what we're doing with the budget down there.
Even in person-to-person crime?
I think we still would have it under person-to-person.
Right.
That's why I have some questions about criminal mischief and telephonic harassment in terms of narrowing it a bit further to say how important are those issues to have included here if we move with this bill.
I personally think they're very important. Telephonic harassment has become a major source of threatened domestic violence, and I'm talking about threats to immediately kill the victim. And criminal mischief can arise to absolutely trashing everything that the person owns. So I think they're very important to be included. They're major forms of domestic violence. They
yeah, but they're not usually person, a couple of they're threats. Not personal. Well, they are person in some ways, but they're not person in the traditional sense of what we know as personal physical injury. I know they're important to domestic violence, right. But they we're talking about physical injury right now, and
well,
we're talking about those are not likely to be. Those two things are not likely to be under any parole supervision, given where we are.
Well, if so, that's a tragedy. But
we've got lots of tragedies here.
Telephonic harassment is often either precedes or is coupled with immediately following carrying out of the threat, and sometimes the threat is and the act is death, but. I think we have to.
Don't you normally? Aren't you able to get restraining orders from one incident of telephone harassment these days?
Yes.
Does that not work?
No, that works. That works.
Well,
but if there may not be a restraining, it may be too late for the restraining order sometimes.
Well, but be certainly too late for a civil compromise too.
Well.
Okay.
No,
go down this track, Judge. This is not going to solve that immediate problem, which is a real one in terms of protecting people.
Well, I was not aware until you said this that there was going to be no probation supervision for example, telephone harassment or criminal mischief. If that's the case. That's a bad situation, but let me just say this, civil compromise, by allowing a phony civil compromise to take the case out of the system altogether and even eliminate the possibility of bench probation or anything that would enforce some sanction against the defendant. I've forgotten how I started the sentence, but civil compromise is no help. Civil compromise is no help because it's not a compromise.
At the risk of sounding unsympathetic, which I am not, but having had some experience in the system, I see on page 18 here we say judges should not accept civil compromises. The judge can always say no.
Right.
I'm not going to accept a civil compromise.
You know,
period.
Yeah, you're right. I'm glad you caught that. Now, usually I'm here saying, trust us, we know what we're doing. And this is an area, Senator Springer, where I can't say that. That civil compromise is used, and I won't name the names of some of my colleagues, but. Is used as a docket management tool, great docket management tool. It gets rid of the cases. It's also there are a lot of judges who subscribe to the idea that this is just a family problem and it's not criminal conduct. And I guess in this instance, I'm asking you to bridle me and my colleagues.
Another question?
Yes.
What if these cases aren't compromised and, you know, the DA is forced to take it to trial because the person who's been accused is not going to plea or for whatever reason, and you have an abusive, continuing, threatened, abusive situation, and I know in Multnomah County, witnesses in misdemeanor cases are rarely subpoenaed. They just get notice of a trial setting. What's the likelihood that that it's going to go to trial in any event, or is that going to put more the opportunity or the invitation to more coercive, threatening behavior increases as, quote, you get to trial and these people are confronting each other in court? And I know that presents itself in any family felony matter. Obviously, the situation's greater, but my sense is you're going to get a lot of cases that are just going to wash out. Only things will have kind of maybe built themselves to a more difficult point at that time. Just
Yeah, I don't think they can get much more difficult than they are, but I think I'd like to defer.
Why? I mean, if the judges don't have to compromise these, why do they?
Why do they?
Yeah.
Just for reasons I said. It's a great docket management tool. If that's what they say they want, that's a way to get rid of another case. And anyway, this is just, that's one reason. The other is this notion that it's just a family dispute anyway, and courts ought not to be involved in it. And I just think that's wrong thinking. But Senator Springer, I'd like to defer answer to your question to Doug Ballou from the District Attorney's Office, who's here, and he's with the heads of the victim's office there, and I think he could answer that better than I can, because I see him once they're there and ready to go.
Okay, well, I don't know that I know the answer, except my sense is, you know, the tough cases will wash out, you know, at the misdemeanor level if there's any reluctance on the part of a witness, even a complaining witness, or inconvenience.
Well, some will, but by allowing these cases to be subject to these phony civil compromises certainly doesn't help the situation. It just makes it worse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ross Shepherd.
Madam Chair, we neglected to include the statement "Do not compromise" in the little judicial report.
Yes, we did. We did. We may have to go back and revisit that one if it ever comes back. Ross.
Good afternoon. I'm Ross Shepherd. I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and I'd like to briefly explain to you the criminal civil compromise process as it's practiced in most jurisdictions around the state, if not Multnomah County. If the defense is able to persuade the victim to sign an acknowledgement of satisfaction, then there is a hearing set up on the motion for civil compromise. And at that hearing, the district attorney will relate to the court what the facts of the case are as were presented in the police reports. And the district attorney, at least in my jurisdiction, and I know in several other counties around the state, will routinely object to the granting of the civil compromise. And the court will certainly take that into consideration in making the decision. Now, the court, I need to stress to you, the court has to make a decision on this. And that decision is whether to enter an order of dismissal pursuant to civil compromise or deny the motion, and the case then is prosecuted as any other case. And this is a non-appealable, unreviewable order by the court. So if the materials that were handed to you by Judge Harrell say that the court should deny these motions, in the appropriate case, the court should and does deny these motions. So there's the filter that we already have. If the court hears of an assault in the fourth degree where a husband has really done grievous damage to his wife, his spouse, the court is not going to allow the civil compromise. And I can testify to you, at least most jurisdictions, if not all jurisdictions other than Portland, around the state. Now, if the court decides to grant the motion, at least in Lane County, and again, I can testify in some other jurisdictions that I know about, in most cases, this would be a conditional grant of the civil compromise, conditioned upon, if it's an abusive husband, the husband going through perhaps anger management or entering into a drug or alcohol rehabilitation situation, if that's indicated, or going through family counseling or mental health. And then the defense would be obligated to come back to the court after 6 months, or as a routine period of time, to report to the court if these conditions have been fulfilled. And the case will not be dismissed until the court sees if the perpetrator has gone through what has been mandated by the court. If the perpetrator has not, the case is then again set down for trial. So it would seem to be a shame for the legislature to say on the first offense there cannot be some sort of civil accommodation, especially if there's been a reconciliation between the husband and the wife. And you'll also note this bill would affect parents and children, and it would be too bad to have to prosecute a child on a first offense if the family is back in a stable and healthy and loving relationship. Thank you.
Thank you. Sharon O'Shea.
Judith Armada and Molly Pruitt of the coalition testified first.
They're not on the list, but why don't you come on forward?
Thank you.
My name's Doug Ballouf. I'm the Director of Victims Assistance in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. To my right is Sharon O'Shea. She is the Director of Victims Assistance in the Clackamas County Victims Assistance Program.
I'll sort of wait till Holly gets here, but my name is Judith Armada. I'm with the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence.
We have had a domestic violence steering committee in Multnomah County now for about 2.5 or 3 years. One of the priorities of that committee has been to rectify the problem that we have had with domestic violence cases. About a third of the cases issued in Multnomah County are terminated by civil compromise. The practice in Multnomah County is that if someone requests a civil compromise, the civil compromise is granted. In my experience, I do not know of a civil compromise in a domestic violence case in Multnomah County that was not granted, despite the fact
that... Will all those cases come to the family court in Multnomah County?
They come to the district criminal court, Senator Cohen.
And who's in charge of the district court there in Multnomah County?
Judge Bearden, Your Honor.
Have you talked with Judge Bearden?
Yes, Judge Bearden is opposed to... Judge Bearden likes civil compromises, I think is the answer. And I think the reason Judge Bearden likes them is he views them as cases that are family matters. They're cases that should not be in the criminal system. I don't want to speak more than that for Judge Bearden. I know he wrote a letter to Representative Kelly about his views, and he simply perceives these as two people have reached a compromise. Excuse me. And the case should be dismissed. The difficulty with this view is that usually by the time a person comes forward, they have been abused many times and physically abused many times. The civil compromise goes into effect simply as a demonstration of the power the abuser continues to hold over the victim. The abuser can beat them. They can go to the police. The abuser can threaten them. The victim will agree to enter into a civil compromise. Civil compromises have no provisions for people to do anything in our county, and as a rule, they don't do anything. Many, if not most, of the people involved in domestic violence cases have some sort of substance abuse problem. All of you know that substance abuse problems are difficult to get people to deal with. We need the help of the courts. We need the help of some sanction in order to get the substance abuse issues dealt with and the anger and violence abuses dealt with. From my point of view, the real issue in front of this committee is that in a violent home, the state does have some obligation to intervene in that home and to try to make that a nonviolent home. This doesn't just impact the woman who may be the mother, but in a home where violence is routine, this kind of activity will impact the children. And I know this session has spent a great deal of time passing bills that help children. And the children will learn violence is an appropriate method of communication. So the question to me is, how do we intervene in these families in a creative manner to end the cycle of violence and the intergenerational cycle of violence? And one way that certainly does not intervene with these families in these domestic violence cases is the routine granting of civil compromises. As you know, each judge is a separately elected official, and I think Senator Springer's question was a good one. Each judge is going to do what each judge feels appropriate in these cases. I can only tell you that in my experience, except for Judge Harrell and maybe one or two other judges, my experience is universal in district court that those compromises are granted as a routine matter of clearing the docket, and that no further scrutiny of those kinds of cases is taken by the courts. And I'm sure that has a lot to do with docket, just the pressure the courts are under there. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have before the other people testify.
We have a little issue of misdemeanor sentencing guidelines that came through. It has to do with what kinds of sanctions are appropriate for physical abuse and misdemeanors. and I hope you'll support that piece of legislation on the House side, because it will give some, at least some minimal directions to judges about what's appropriate with any kind of misdemeanor, any kind of assaultive kind of person-to-person misdemeanor sanctions.
Does Ms. Swenson have that bill number?
Yeah, we do. Thank you. And we have judges who don't want to even look at that listing either.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
That's why my preference, actually, in this arena, especially of domestic violence, I much prefer the House bill before us than the primer.
Yeah. Okay. Sharon.
What I have to say comes from a slightly different angle. In Clackamas County, in the Victim Assistance Division, those reports are routinely channeled to victim assistance after being reviewed by the Deputy District Attorney on intake. We make contact with over 600 victims of domestic violence a year. That's just of the cases that come to the District Attorney's Office that we see. In my experience, I have not seen any misdemeanor crimes under the Abuse Prevention Act, which were civilly compromised, that have ever resulted in an improvement in that domestic violence situation. In fact, I've seen the opposite.
Quite different with Clackamas County, then?
Absolutely.
So you don't approve them in Clackamas County, civil compromise?
No. In fact, civil compromise is something that is rarely ever seen. That's not dealt with very often in Clackamas County. So where I'm coming from is a different aspect of my concern about the bill or for passing it. What I see is the opposite of improvement in those situations, because the offenders have the impression in domestic violence situations that that crime is not in fact a crime as such. It's something that the victim is punishing them for, because it is viewed as a choice of civil compromise or criminal prosecution. And I think it gives the defendant, the abuser, an upper hand. And I see them coercing victims on a daily basis from the victims I deal with. I can sit down with those victims and I can tell them what the person in their life is like and what they have probably said to them, and their mouths fall open. They are so overwhelmed that I could know something about, as much as I do, about total strangers. But it happens that often that after all of the years of doing this on a daily basis, you really do know what that power structure is like. And so the time we spend with the victims is telling them that it is not their case, no matter what. If it's a civil compromise issue, they do think that it's their case. The offender believes that it's the victim's case and that the victim is doing this to them. So what we tell our domestic violence victims is, this is not your case. This is the state's case. The district attorney decides whether or not to prosecute it. You are, as cold as it sounds, the victim witness in this case. If the person who has abused you has a problem understanding that and does not believe you because they don't believe the victims, you tell them to call me and I will be glad to explain that this was an assault or a menacing or harassment or whatever under the Abuse Prevention Act, and that it was a crime against the laws of the state. That's where I come from on this. That's why I think it's important not to add the issue of civil compromise to those situations, because of the control element that the abuser has over the victim.
Thank you. Yes, coming from Clackamas County, it's hard for me to understand this bill particularly. So, Judith?
Yes, Chair Cohen, members of the committee, counsel. Judith Armada for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I would like to say that the bulk of our formal testimony will be presented by our Executive Director, Holly Pruitt, but I wanted to...
We're about done here.
Okay. She's just going to make a few very brief comments, and I also want to make very brief comments. What I wanted to say also is that the misdemeanor sentencing guidelines, we participated in that process and provided testimony to in their proceedings. And as a result of the testimony that we provided, they changed the preference for family violence assaults, and they made that a jail preference instead of a counseling preference. And I think that it's important, because what we're saying here is we really want the system to hold these situations accountable, to hold the perpetrators in these situations accountable. We've worked with the legislature for the past 15 years to put some teeth into the law and to have it seen as a crime and not a family matter where we could shut the door and abandon these people. And I think what's happened is that now we've, through our innovative and creative bar, we found the civil compromise is a way, again, to keep these things out of the system. They're not fun. People don't know what to do about them. They don't create wonderful solutions. We have a lot of work to do to get to those wonderful solutions, but this is helping us to avoid them. So I think that that's important to remember and to also know that we are pressing for some of those solutions. The last thing that I really wanted to say was that we did a survey of our programs around the state, and there are 31 of them. And 22 of the counties, we had responses on that survey, and we asked them about the use of civil compromise. And in all but four of those counties, it was being used at least some of the time. So it's a pretty high use of civil compromise as a way to keep domestic violence cases, again, out of the system, and I think that that's significant. I also talked with the Victims Assistance Office in Washington County, and over the last year, in 1990, one-fourth of their cases were civilly compromised, and sometimes over the objection of the district attorney. So that's really all I had to say.
Holly?
Thank you. I'm Holly Pruitt, Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence, and I have provided you with written testimony. I would like to just reinforce a couple of points very briefly. And the first is that the reason that we need this bill is because the judiciary, like the law enforcement community, like every aspect of our society, is still saturated with the belief that domestic violence is not as serious as other types of assaults. And that's why we had to pass mandatory arrest provisions only for domestic violence. That's why we had to put in place free self-help restraining orders only for domestic violence. And that's why, again, civil compromise needs to be looked at as a special case in domestic violence, that it's not appropriate. Domestic violence assaults are more serious and demand a more rigorous intervention than non-familial assaults because of the continuous access and the guaranteed escalation of danger in domestic violence cases. We're not talking about civil compromises in cases where there's only been one slap, one brief hit. The fact is, those cases do not come to the attention of the criminal justice system. By the time someone's calling the law, it's usually because it's escalated to a point of very serious lethality. 3 out of 4 female homicide victims were murdered by their husbands or by their partners. The increase in lethality to a battered woman